Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. When we hear the phrase love triangle, it conjures up all kinds of romantic imagery. It's as old as Greek mythology, gaining momentum during the exaggerated lyricism of Shakespeare. Operas, novels, movies, soap operas, they all give us the idea that a love triangle is the epitome of romance, where a beautiful woman is so desired, she can hardly choose between her two lovers. Even in more current pop culture, the trope of the love triangle was explored ad nauseum in the popular Twilight series of books and movies. It usually involves a good, safe man, and of course, the bad boy. But is it a love triangle if one of the suitors is unaware he has competition? Life is often stranger than fiction, but usually, it's depressingly mundane. Michelle Thayer found herself in what is often described as a love triangle, but in reality, she was simply a cheater. Her husband, just the cuckold, a trope just as old, but much more sad, than the romantic notion of a love triangle. And did Michelle really love her other suitor, or was he just a means to an end for her? A life where she chooses neither man, but instead rises from the ashes like a phoenix, starting her life over, without the constraints of marital bonds or the obsessive love of her other suitor, a man who had served his purpose. But Michelle Thayer was no phoenix. She was a black widow, ensnaring more than just two men in her web of lies before her ultimate downfall. Welcome to episode 71, The Tangled Web of Dr. Michelle Thayer. Fayetteville, North Carolina is home of the 82nd Airborne and the U.S. Army Special Operations Command. Fayetteville is also home to several museums of military, art, and history, and is famous for being the first American city named for the Marquis de Lafayette, the French aristocrat and military officer who fought in the Revolutionary War. After returning to his home country, the Marquis was a key figure in the French Revolution as well. 17 counties, more than 70 towns and cities, and hundreds of streets in America are named for the Marquis de Lafayette. I have discussed the city of Fayetteville at length in two other episodes, the Tim Hennis case and the Jeffrey McDonald case. Both of those killers were stationed in Fort Bragg, located in Fayetteville. Fayetteville hasn't had the best reputation over the years. It was nicknamed Fayette-Nam in the 1970s because Fort Bragg was the last stop for American soldiers before they headed to Southeast Asia. The city of Fayetteville molded itself around the needs of that sort of transient population. Bars, strip clubs, and a booming drug culture overtook downtown Fayetteville, just 10 minutes from Fort Bragg. City leaders knew they had a problem, and it took time, but they did try to make changes. But decades of urban replanning with renewal projects and the reorganization of police forces hasn't done much to change Fayetteville. The city's violent crime rate at 39.1 is still significantly higher than many cities of the same size. The national average is 22.7. Those are current figures, and as you can guess, they were not much better some 20 years ago when Michelle Thayer shocked and scandalized the city and military community. Michelle actually grew up an Army brat herself. Her father was in the Air Force. She was born in Taylor County, Texas, on December 9, 1970, but grew up in Colorado. Her parents, Ann and Thomas Forcier, divorced in the mid-1980s. And Michelle helped her mother raise her younger siblings, Angela and Tom. In high school, she met Frank Martin Thayer, also a military brat. He was born in Germany on February 26, 1969. But his father was schizophrenic and divorced his mother Linda when Marty was still a baby. He never really knew his dad. His mother, Linda Gettler, raised Marty on her own in Colorado with the support of her parents. For a father figure, Marty relied on his grandfather, Al Dunbar, who got him interested in Boy Scouts, took him camping and fishing, and encouraged Marty to follow his dreams. Young Marty wanted to be an astronaut. In high school, Marty and Michelle quickly became inseparable. Michelle was 15 and Marty was a year older and a grade ahead of her. but they remained high school sweethearts and stayed together after graduation. Marty enlisted in the Air Force in May of 1991. It was the start of his dream of becoming an astronaut. He would eventually become a C-130 pilot and reach the rank of captain. Michelle followed a family tradition set by her father and grandfather by joining the Air Force Reserves after she graduated. She would go on to serve 12 months in Operation Desert Shield, eventually becoming a tech sergeant. After her service, the GI Bill covered much of the cost of college for Michelle. But she did have to take out student loans to make up for what the GI Bill and her salary from the reserves didn't cover. The couple wanted to wait until Marty graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy to get married. The academy wasn't far from home in Colorado Springs, and the couple married in June of 1991 when Michelle was 20 and Marty was 21. Right after they married, Marty and Michelle moved to Vance Air Force Base in Enid, Oklahoma for flight school. Marty had given up his dream of becoming an astronaut after he grappled with a long waiting list and decided to become a pilot instead. Then in October of 1992, they moved back to Colorado for Marty to attend flight operations school in Denver. As usual with military careers, they kept moving. The next stop was Falcon Air Base near Colorado Springs, where Marty earned his master's degree and Michelle finished her bachelor's degree, which she had begun at the University of Northern Colorado. She received a BA in psychology and sociology, and more importantly, she had found her calling. She had always been an average student before, not showing much interest in academics, but she blossomed in college in her chosen career path. And Marty was doing well too. After he earned his master's degree, the couple moved to Melbourne, Florida, where Marty was stationed at Patrick Air Force Base, and Michelle began grad school at the Florida Institute of Technology. She was studying clinical psychology. In hindsight, their early time in Florida was some of the happiest time in their marriage. Michelle never liked being far from her family, but she did like living in Florida. They embraced the Florida beach lifestyle and enjoyed scuba diving, skydiving, and paragliding. But Michelle's happiness in Florida was short-lived. Soon, Marty was being deployed to Kuwait and was gone for months at a time. She became lonely and depressed, and she missed her family. But in 1997, she finished her master's degree in clinical psychology, with her thesis reflecting her own military background. It was titled Women in Modern Warfare, Role of Personality Hardiness and Coping Skills. Her family flew into town for graduation, and they later characterized Marty as being extremely proud of Michelle and so excited for her. 2 years later, she earned her doctorate and began seeing patients individually and at local clinics in Florida. She then moved to Alabama for an internship, and Marty was transferred to Moody Air Force Base in Valdosta, Georgia. This is when their marriage began to really struggle. For the first time, they kept separate households. Finally living as an adult on her own, Michelle began to resent the way Marty insisted on an Army-regimented, clean and tidy house. She realized she'd been cleaning up after him for years, and also following him all over the United States to different bases, often having to change schools to accommodate his career, delaying her own progress. Also in 1999, Michelle claims to have found something on Marty's computer that made her believe he was having an affair. It's unclear what she actually found, and there was never any evidence that Marty actually had an affair. In the book, The Officer's Wife, it is speculated that Michelle found internet porn, which obviously isn't the same as having an affair, but it is very upsetting for many people. But I'm not sure it was as much upsetting as it was perhaps titillating for Michelle. She may have felt jealous at the time, but she would soon embark in an online life that would make a porn internet search blush in comparison. I'm going to pause now for a commercial break. Hey, Have you heard of moissanite, the world's most brilliant gem? It's a lab-made gemstone that outshines any other gemstones in the world. Charles and Colvard has been creating and perfecting moissanite for over 20 years. Moissanite is an ethically sound, revolutionary product offered at an incredible value. You will find no better price for the brilliance, durability, color, cut, and clarity found in moissanite gems. All Charles & Colvard jewelry is made with 95% recycled precious metals. Charles & Colvard showcases a collection of solitaire, three-stone, halo, and side-stone engagement rings. Your hand will sparkle as moissanite is double-refractive, offering more fire and brilliance than any other gemstone in the world. Charles & Colvard also offer a chic collection of necklaces, earrings, and stacker rings, all in 14-karat gold, as part of the Oro Edition line of jewelry. Charles & Colvard created gems are the pinnacle of moissanite, with their brand, Forever One, being unparalleled in the marketplace. Learn more and get exclusive savings at charlesandcolvard.com/southernfried. Once again, go to charlesandcolvard.com/southernfried to find the perfect, unique, and brilliant gemstone. After spending 5 months apart, Michelle finished her internship, and Marty was yet again transferred, this time to Pope Air Force Base near Fayetteville, North Carolina. She went with him. It was their sixth move in 8 years of marriage. Michelle was not thrilled by the prospect of Fayetteville or of learning another city she was unfamiliar with. She thought finding work would be difficult. But a colleague at her last university connected her with Dr. Thomas Harbin, who had an office in Fayetteville. He was impressed with Michelle's resume, and she signed as a contract psychologist with his practice. She had to get a provisional license in North Carolina that would take a year to be upgraded to a full license. This meant that she couldn't bill major insurance companies, but she did build a small caseload at Dr. Harbin's and also worked as an adjunct faculty member at Webster University Graduate School at Pope and Campbell University at Fort Bragg. Author Michael Freeman said that Michelle never warmed to Fayetteville, though she had been able to find work and she did make friends within the military community. Despite making friends, she missed her family. She was about to turn 30 years old, and Marty had begun talking about wanting to have children, something Michelle didn't feel ready to do at this stage in her career, and certainly didn't want to do it so far from the support system of her family. Lonely, depressed, and aggravated with Marty, she turned to the internet. She started posting online ads looking for anonymous sexual hookups. Her screen name was Married Brunette, and she usually had an alias in her communications. She called herself Susan, Cheryl, or Shelley. One of her ads read, quote, "Sexy brunette seeks rendezvous man. Attractive, intelligent, very sensual professional seeks regular activity partner 2 to 3 times a week for long, hot, passionate encounters. Looking for emotionally stable, very attractive, physically fit, intellectually stimulating, fun-loving man who is not going bald. 25 to 35, Caucasian, drug, disease-free, over 6 feet tall, must live or work in Fayetteville. I turn heads. If you do too and meet all of the above requirements, let's meet for coffee and see what happens next. We'll only respond to inquiries that are interesting and stimulating. Discretion is a must." Michelle met many men anonymously who answered her ads, but there were only two she had real relationships with. The first was Charles McClendon. They had a 3-month sexual relationship, and while Charles had obviously met Michelle in an online ad, he seemed to think the two were exclusive. She had told him her real name pretty quickly, and while he didn't mind the fact that she was married, he hacked into her email account and was livid to discover she was still seeing other men from online ads. He said he was concerned with STDs, and maybe he was, but it also sounds like jealousy. He figured out her email password fairly easily. It was cheater, in all caps. He broke off the relationship, and Michelle moved on quickly. Whatever strong feelings Charles had, Michelle apparently didn't have trouble ending the relationship. She was more angry about the violation of her privacy, understandably. In the spring of 2000, Marty and Michelle's relationship was unraveling. He was still trying to make it work, but Michelle seemed to have already emotionally distanced herself from her husband. Perhaps it was the anonymous sex, and much has been made about whether or not she was a sex addict. A psychologist later said she suffered from depression and self-esteem issues, also common to any form of addiction. But I think the affairs were a symptom of a larger problem. Michelle had simply fallen out of love with Marty. It's not uncommon in many marriages of this length, and it's certainly not uncommon in military marriages, with the pressures of constantly moving and the long months apart. After the affair with Charles ended, Michelle grew more aggressive and bold in her internet hookups. She started going to underground swinger parties, often held at hotels, having sex with multiple partners, both men and women. And for a while, she saw a man named Chris, who shared her interest in experimentation. They met up with another couple for a foursome. Despite Michelle's secret life, she was giving Marty ultimatums rather than asking for a divorce. She insisted he attend couples counseling. On June 27th, Michelle and Marty saw a couples counselor for the first time. In this session, Michelle said, "I've changed, and I think Marty needs to recognize that." For his part, Marty said, "I don't understand why Michelle isn't able to work this out with me." The therapist wrote that the couple existed in an atmosphere of significant disagreement, which stemmed from long-standing conflicts. Michelle wanted freedom, and Marty struggled to understand and deal with it. The couple was supposed to attend a session together on July 6th, but only Marty showed up. Michelle had rented an apartment from July to September of the year 2000. She called this a temporary therapeutic separation. Marty told their marriage counselor that he didn't understand why Michelle didn't want to be together. He said, "I guess she just doesn't love me anymore." But said that things had only been bad recently. Also, he said he felt like he was the only one working on the marriage. Although he did admit that his tidiness probably bothered Michelle, he didn't think it was enough for her to leave him. I think the real reason Michelle finally left Marty was she had met a man named John Diamond online, beginning a sexual relationship with him in February of 2000. This was Michelle's first really intense relationship to come out of her affairs. John Diamond was 28 years old, tall and handsome, and was also an army man. His father had served in Vietnam, and John attended many military schools, training to become a ranger and a sniper. He also happened to be married himself to a woman named Lourdes he had met while stationed in Panama. He had a daughter from a previous marriage, and he and Lourdes married in 1996, having a son not long after. But by November of 1999, they were legally separated, though still living together. To Michelle, John was everything that the reserved Marty was not. In the book The Officer's Wife, John is described as spontaneous, action-oriented, and self-assured to the point of cockiness. The affair with John Diamond was steamy from the start. He met her enthusiasm for sex equally, but he also wanted more from Michelle. He really loved her. Their email correspondence was voluminous, and while Michelle's was often playful and sexy in tone, John's were more passionate. One email read, quote, "I just don't want to lose you. I have never loved anyone or anything as much as I love you." And they carried on their affair out in the open, especially when Marty was deployed. Michelle would bring John over to the home she shared with Marty. Neighbors definitely took notice of the affair, and John bragged to all of his friends about Michelle. They even referred to each other as fiancés. But there was one person who was oblivious to this affair, Marty Thier. He was often deployed for weeks at a time, and it's not as though his marriage wasn't rocky before this affair began. Lourdes, John's wife, also claimed ignorance to the affair. However, she knew that John slept around. She had long accepted it as part of their marriage, and it was John who had decided to legally separate in 1999. So while she may not have understood how serious the relationship with Michelle was, she was certainly under no illusions about her husband's affairs. However, by the end of that July, Michelle did return to counseling with her husband. This time they discussed boundaries. Michelle wanted Marty to call before he came over to her apartment, most likely because she constantly had John over. She never mentioned the affair in the counseling sessions, and this was the last time they saw the therapist together. The therapist would later testify that during the couple's sessions, He felt like Michelle was not looking for common ground and was attempting to distance herself from the marriage. He said she was not motivated to undertake therapy. But he did feel like Marty indeed wanted to make the marriage work and was attempting to accommodate Michelle's wishes. He also said Marty was the one putting all the energy and trying to get things back together. In August, Marty and Michelle went to see a chaplain on the Air Force base. In their first session, the couple discussed difficulties in their marriage. By the second session, Michelle confronted Marty about the affair she claimed to believe he had. According to Michelle, Marty admitted to looking for a woman on the internet, but never actually sleeping with one. But we only have Michelle's word for this. After the second session, the chaplain said he was ill-equipped to handle their needs, excusing himself on the basis that the theories were agnostic. Next, Michelle went to see a psychiatrist alone. She was diagnosed with depression. Over the next 4 months, she was prescribed various combinations of the antidepressants Celexa and Paxil, the anti-anxiety medications Xanax and Klonopin, and the sleeping pills Ambien and Sonata. Michelle continued to live in the apartment until the end of September when her lease was up. She had John over almost every single day. It was like they were living together. Even though Michelle went back to Marty, she and John continued their affair. Michelle grew more unhappy with Marty as the days went on. She didn't think Marty was fun, complaining that he didn't like to go out or do anything, which is a common reason for someone cheating on their spouse. Other people noticed how unhappy Michelle was. When Marty's mother came to visit, she heard Michelle call Marty stupid and watched Michelle shrug off a hug from her husband. Michelle had actually started planning her divorce from Marty. She wanted to wait to file for divorce until after Marty got his reenlistment bonus, which could be from $60,000 to $200,000. But until he got the bonus, she could plan everything else out. She made a list of their assets and debts on her laptop and how they should be divided in the divorce. She even applied for a job on the Caribbean island of Saba. In late September, Michelle applied to the Saba University School of Medicine. On the application, she marked that she was single and could start after the first of the year. She took John with her when she went to go interview with the administrators. They registered at the hotel under the names Mr. and Mrs. Thier. But Michelle did not talk to the university again. She had changed her mind and didn't want to relocate. She would have to be relicensed again, and there was now another reason. After Saba, Michelle distanced herself from John. He was constantly emailing her love letters. He was talking about leaving the military and moving. He also brought up wanting to have children with Michelle. She felt suffocated now in this relationship, just as she had with Marty. Michelle broke up with John on November 19th. In her email, she told John she couldn't move with him after he left the army. She didn't want to move again. She'd moved around her entire life. She wrote, "I truly mean it when I say I do not have the physical, emotional, spiritual, or mental energy to consider any such plan of action." In response, John sent a bunch of really sad emails saying things like, "I will never understand why you forsake us. I would never leave you. I would never not love you." Michelle must have been touched by the emails because she got back together with John, but it wasn't the same. She was reluctant and didn't reply to many of his calls or emails. John definitely noticed the difference, and he overcompensated with even more love letters. On December 9th, 2000, Michelle and John went to Raleigh to celebrate Michelle's 30th birthday. They stayed at a hotel that night and then traveled back to Fayetteville the next day. After only a few hours apart, John asked Michelle to meet him for coffee. She agreed, but never showed up. The next day, December 11th, John sent Michelle an ominous email. Quote, "I signed my life insurance over to you 2 weeks ago. I'll make it look like an accident so there's no problem with the money. I wanted to spend my life with you, but since I'm so easily thrown away by you, I guess I'm not worth that much. So, oh well. It was a hell of a ride. A friend is squaring me away with something. I'll take a few hours to think about life and maybe write something. I will always love you and hopefully see you in another life. I love you, John." The next day, he wrote another email saying he tried to pull the trigger 3 times, but couldn't do it because he knew it would hurt her. In this email, he asked Michelle why she would stay with Marty when he made her miserable. But he had also gone back to Lourdes since Michelle was staying with Marty. On December 16th, John was hanging out at his friend's house and he called Michelle. After getting off the phone, John sat quietly. When his friends asked what was going on, John said Michelle was raped by her husband and was thinking of hiring someone to kill him. John said he told her it wasn't a good idea, and his friend said he should beat Marty up. John said he offered, but Michelle said to leave him alone. I believe this is because John and Michelle already had a plan. And John was sowing the seeds for a mysterious hitman in case he ever came under suspicion. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from our sponsors. We all know we should be drinking more water. I don't know about you, but I struggle because I miss the flavor of fruit juices and sodas. That's why I'm so excited to tell you about our new sponsor, Circle. Circle makes drinking water convenient, fun, and tasty. My whole family loves it. Circle is a convenient water bottle and flavored cartridge system. The bottle has a flavor dial that allows me to customize the amount of flavor I get. I love turning that dial up or down depending on my mood. With over 30 natural flavors, including fruit blends and iced coffee varieties, there are plenty for you to choose from and fall in love with. So far, my favorites are raspberry lemonade and the caffeinated strawberry watermelon. Just one Circle flavor cartridge provides more than 6 water bottles of your new favorite drink. No more wasting money on endless bottles of water from the grocery store. Circle's custom flavor cartridges are sugar-free with 0 calories. Circle uses all natural flavoring and no artificial colors, and it's really helped my family cut back on sugary sodas. Right now, you can get your own Circle bottle plus 2 flavor cartridges for just $5 by going to drinkcircle.com/southernfried and then enter the code southernfried. That's drinkcircle, CIRKUL.com/southernfried, and then enter the code southernfried to get your Circle bottle and 2 drink cartridges for just $5. Fall is a great time to set new goals and get back into a healthy routine, just as you're sending the kiddos back to school and into their normal routine. Whether you're looking for glowing skin, more energy, or better sleep, Care of is there for you. Care of delivers vitamin packets, protein and energy powders, and more right to your door. It can be really hard to know which vitamins and supplements you should be taking, but Care of makes it easy to figure out what you really need. Care of's 5-minute quiz asks you about your health needs, your diet and lifestyle, to get your personal vitamin and supplement recommendations. I love the convenience of Care of products delivered right to my door in cute individual packets with my name on them. When I travel, I just throw a few packets in my suitcase and I'm good to go. You can modify your subscription at any time when your needs or preferences change. Care of also offers vegan and vegetarian supplements to match your dietary needs and make sure you're getting the nutrients you need for those specific diets. Care of wants to make sure what you're putting into your body comes from the best sources. Their website offers full transparency, and Care of ensures only the highest quality products. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter promo code southernfried. That's takecareof.com and enter the promo code southernfried. Dr. Harbin, Michelle's boss, had asked her and his office manager, Heidi, to go to dinner to celebrate Christmas. Michelle said Marty would be disappointed if he wasn't invited, but that wasn't true. Marty actually had an early flight the next day and did not want to go. But Dr. Harbin opened the dinner up to spouses after Michelle's request. And when Michelle asked Marty to go, she told him that Dr. Harbin wanted him there. On December 17th, 2000, the day after Michelle supposedly told John that Marty had raped her, Michelle and Marty joined her boss, his wife, Heidi, and her boyfriend for dinner at the Fox and Hound restaurant in Raleigh. The two couples had a nice dinner with Dr. Harbin and his wife. No one noticed any strange behavior from Michelle or Marty. After dinner, Marty and Michelle stopped for gas at a nearby gas station. While at the station, Michelle claimed she realized she left books in her office that she needed for teaching a class the next day, and asked Marty to drive her to the office. She said she went upstairs to her office while Marty stayed in the car. She claimed she was in her office for less than 4 minutes when she heard gunshots outside. She said she ran to the door and saw Marty on the ground. She claimed he was breathing, but not responsive. Supposedly, the office door had automatically locked behind Michelle as she ran downstairs, so she couldn't get back inside her office. So she ran 200 yards to a local video store. It was 10:57 p.m. as caught on security footage. Two employees were in the back office when Michelle came in. She yelled, "Is anyone in here?" They came out and found Michelle at the counter. They later said she had no shoes on and her hands and face were covered in blood. They said Michelle was hysterical, but they knew she needed them to call 911, so they did and handed her the phone. Michelle told the dispatcher that her husband had been shot. She gave the address and then ran back out the door to wait for the police and ambulance. Fayetteville police got there first and were pulling Michelle off Marty as paramedics rushed over to try and save his life. He had several wounds that were gushing blood, but he was not breathing. They attempted CPR, but it was too late. Marty Thier was dead. He was 31 years old. Michelle recounted the events of the night to one police officer, saying she wasn't sure if she saw anyone, but she thought she saw something out of the corner of her eye near the bushes at the back of the building. Michelle was taken to a heated patrol car as the police waited for her to calm down. She was able to identify herself and her husband. Paramedics took her blood pressure and vital signs for shock, but she was fine. She didn't need medical attention. She explained about being locked out of her office and said she lost her shoes while running to the video store for help. Her shoes were found in a nearby parking lot. A canine unit showed up and the dog picked up a scent near the bushes Michelle had indicated, but then lost the trail after it led into a nearby golf course. They thought it was possible that's where the shooter had parked. Police canvassed the neighborhood and talked to one neighbor who said she heard three gunshots at 10:50 p.m. Another couple told the police they also heard three gunshots. Then they thought they heard a fourth one as the husband had looked outside. Another neighbor said he heard four shots. One of the officers on scene finally told Michelle that her husband was dead. He said her face went blank, and then she cried for 10 minutes. Michelle agreed to have her hands tested for gunshot residue at the scene. Next, Sergeant Ralph Klinkscales arrived at the scene. He would become the lead investigator on the case. He saw Marty lying in a pool of blood near the front passenger side of his Ford Explorer. Marty was dressed for a holiday party. He wore a suit with a Christmas tie and sequined red suspenders. That detail kind of breaks my heart. He had been shot five times. One bullet went through his left forearm and into his chest. He was also hit in his lower back, his right buttock, and his left thigh. But the kill shot was point-blank execution style to the back of his head, behind his left ear. Next to his body were two casings from a 9mm gun. In his wallet was $66 and the keys to the Explorer. Whoever killed him hadn't done it for the money or the car. Sergeant Klinkscales walked up the staircase to Michelle's office, noting tiny blood drops on the upper steps. He found red sequins from Marty's suspenders on the landing, and there were bullet holes on the side of the building, just above the doorframe. He believed that the shooter was at the base of the stairs, firing up at Marty, who was standing at the top. The shooter had fired up the stairs at Marty and kept shooting as Marty fell down the stairs. Once he was on the ground, the shooter fired the final bullet into his head. The sergeant asked Michelle why Marty wasn't in his car. She said she had no idea, but maybe he got tired of waiting for her or needed to use the restroom. He asked her if she owned or had recently fired a gun. She said no. He asked her about her relationship with Marty, and she admitted they had recently hit a rough patch and went to couples counseling the previous summer. Klinkscales later said Michelle would alternate between crying and calm throughout the questioning. She gave permission for her office and the Explorer to be searched. Michelle's office was neat, and her keys were on her desk, as she said they would be. The office was not dusted for fingerprints, as investigators believed that neither Marty nor the killer had come inside the office. They found no fingerprints on the Explorer, but Michelle's cell phone and purse were under the driver's seat. Marty's cell phone was also in the car. Why would Michelle run to the video store with two cell phones right there in the unlocked car? Officers offered to drive Michelle home as the scene was still being processed, but she refused. She said she would drive herself. But the police insisted on an escort and followed her to the house. They wanted to confiscate the clothing she was wearing and did not want her out of their sight until they got it. It was now around 6 a.m. the following day, December 18th. By 7 a.m., the police were interviewing Michelle's boss. Dr. Harbin knew there had been marital difficulties and that they had separated briefly. He also knew about the affair with John, though he didn't know his last name. He only knew he was a sniper with the Special Forces, stationed at Fort Bragg. The police also questioned Heidi and her boyfriend, who didn't notice anything unusual that night, and even said that Marty and Michelle held hands at dinner. When asked about a man named John, Heidi said she didn't know much, but that a man named John had called the office to speak with Michelle because he was worried about her. He said that Michelle told him that Marty was abusing her. Heidi thought it was strange, as Michelle had never said anything like that to her, but she passed along the message to Michelle without comment. Heidi also mentioned that Michelle excused herself at dinner to go and make a phone call around 9 p.m. Now Sergeant Klinkscales had something to go on. He went to Michelle's house at 9:30 that morning to talk to her again. She didn't deny the relationship with John and supplied his last name. She said she had dated John Diamond over the summer while she and Marty were separated, but she had broken it off when she got back together with her husband. She said they were still friends and admitted she had talked to him on the day of Marty's murder. She said it was about her car, a yellow Corvette that John used to get serviced for her when they dated. It was having mechanical troubles, and she wanted to know where she should take it to get it fixed. So she had a story ready for when they checked her phone records. Sergeant Klinkscales took all of this in and ended the interview by asking Michelle if Marty had life insurance. Without hesitation, she said he had a policy for $500,000. He then left to go meet John Diamond at Fort Bragg. John declined to speak with him as he was on duty, but agreed to come down to the police station for a formal interview the next day. During the interview, he told police about his background. When asked if he knew about Marty's murder, John said he saw it on the news. John readily admitted to the affair with Michelle, explaining he answered her online ad in early 2000. But unlike Michelle, he claimed the relationship was still ongoing. He said they had had sex the weekend before the murder and went for lunch the day before the murder. He said he didn't remember her calling about the Corvette as she had told police. John told police he didn't own any personal guns, per the Army's rules. You cannot own a private weapon and live on base. But he said he did often rent guns to shoot at a firing range. In fact, he had gone on December 18th, the day after Marty's murder. This was verified by receipts, which was pretty convenient, because once the police verified the story, they didn't bother testing John's hand for gunshot residue. As for an alibi the night Marty was murdered, John claimed he was at home watching a movie with his wife and mother-in-law. Afterwards, they all went to bed around 10 p.m., and he didn't leave the apartment until the next morning. The sergeant asked John if he could confirm the story with his wife, and John said yes, but only if he could call and tell her the police were coming, and if they didn't mention the affair with Michelle. The police agreed, and John called Lourdes. He was fluent in Spanish and spoke to his wife in her native language. The police had no idea he was telling her exactly what to say to them. This is strictly my opinion, but I don't see why they needed John's permission to question his wife. He was admittedly in an affair with Michelle. They had reason to doubt his alibi. And now they had given him a way to control the interview with Lourdes. And Lourdes did stand by her man. She said they were separated and that John slept in a different room in the apartment with the children. She slept in a room with her mother. She said on that night, John had fallen asleep on the couch. But she did admit that she was a deep sleeper, so she couldn't be sure if he left after she went to bed. And for the record, she spoke perfect English, just with a heavy accent. Her mother, Priscilla, confirmed Lourdes' story, with Lourdes standing there to translate. Priscilla didn't speak English at all. I would also like to point out that after John made the call in Spanish, the police should have brought their own translator to the interview. Not that he should have been allowed to make the call in the first place. The Air Force held a memorial on base for Marty on December 21st. Michelle, her parents, and Marty's mother attended the service. Marty's family kept asking the family questions, and they decided to hold a briefing following the memorial service. But police told the family, pointedly, that Michelle was not invited. She was furious, and also asked that the police not mention her affair with John. A liaison from Pope Air Force Base, where Marty had been stationed, allowed Michelle to attend the briefing. She was later dressed down by her commander for interfering. She was supposed to be there to represent Marty's interests, not Michelle's. The police had obviously wanted the families to know Michelle was under suspicion, in hopes that one of them might know something. The liaison had ruined that opportunity. After the briefing, Michelle requested a meeting with Sergeant Klinkscales. She said a couple of days before the memorial, she had met John for coffee so that she could look him in the eye and ask him if he had killed Marty. She said he told her no, and she believed him. And then she confessed that she had lied about their relationship being over. She had still been seeing John, and she knew it would look bad. The sergeant asked if she would take a lie detector test and wear a wire the next time she saw John. She said she'd think about it. On December 28th, Marty Thier was laid to rest in Colorado Springs. The police were still investigating the Thier marriage and questioned Marty's former commander in Florida. He said in 1997, Marty's work performance suffered, and when he questioned him about it, Marty said that Michelle had found porn on his computer and was upset. Again, there is no evidence that Marty ever had an affair or even talked to anyone online. In the first week of January 2001, Michelle hired two defense lawyers. She wanted them to get more out of the police, but the police weren't talking to them either. The police got an anonymous tip about a man named Charles McClendon. That would be the guy Michelle slept with, who cracked her email password and broke up with her for sleeping around, even though he had met her through an online ad. Charles confirmed the story to police, and it painted Michelle in an even worse light. She had acted as though John Diamond was her only marital indiscretion. That was far from true, and her secret life was about to be exposed. And the police were still suspicious of John. Whether or not they thought he coached Lourdes, the alibi wasn't airtight. John's situation in living with his wife while separated seemed strange, but he said it was a matter of finances. But now the police found that he had filed for divorce from Lourdes on December 18th, the day after Marty's murder, and before he talked to police, and before Lourdes gave him the shaky alibi. John and Lourdes both had left this out of their stories to the police. John was asked to take a polygraph after this, but declined. Michelle was asked again, but said she would need to check with her attorneys. Just days later, her attorneys told police that all contact needed to go through their office and not to contact Michelle directly. John started spending the night at Michelle's house around this time, and it continued into February. But ridiculously, he parked in front of neighbors' houses, even though everyone knew what was going on. The neighbors eventually got pissed and called the cops. The license plate belonged to John Diamond. By the middle of February, the police had John's phone records, and it led them to a friend of his named Peyton Donald. He had spoken with this friend the morning after Marty's murder. They questioned Peyton at the station and asked him if he owned a gun. He said he owned a Smith & Wesson 9mm and admitted he no longer had it. He had lent it to his good friend, John Diamond. The police had Peyton call and ask John for the gun. John said it was in his car and he would bring it to them. And then an hour later, he called the military police on base and said his car had been broken into. The MPs thought the break-in looked fake. Broken glass would normally be everywhere, and it wasn't. The stereo was still there, and the glove box hadn't even been touched. But John insisted there had been a gun in the car, and it was stolen. Which seems incredibly stupid, as he was not allowed to possess a privately owned gun on a military base. But admitting to that offense would be the only way he could explain his friend Peyton's story. But he had now admitted to breaking a law. He was handcuffed and taken to a military police interrogation room. He still insisted the gun was stolen, along with some CDs and cash, but he didn't explain why he had the gun to begin with. He was released back to the barracks by midnight, and Michelle picked him up the next morning. He had been ordered to show up at the Criminal Investigation Command on base at 1 p.m. the next day. He was also due for company formation at 6:30 a.m. He didn't show up either time. Though he had also been ordered to stay on base, he had disappeared. He didn't go far, though. They found him about 100 yards away in the woods. He was taken back and put on barracks restriction. The same neighbors who called the police about John's car being parked in front of their house also called the Air Force and reported John. The police now asked the neighbors if they would be willing to put up cameras, and they were. In late February, Michelle called Peyton and said she needed to meet him immediately. She said she had something to give him. He asked if they could meet the next day, and then he immediately called the police. They asked him to wear a wire, and he agreed. But Michelle didn't show up at the time and place they had agreed on, telling Peyton explicitly that she thought he would wear a wire. The police were assuming that she intended to return the gun. After the fake burglary and Michelle contacting Peyton, the police felt they had enough to arrest John. Of course, he would be facing a military court-martial, not a civilian trial. He was denied bail, and his father hired a private attorney for him. He was not allowed contact with Michelle, but the two schemed to use John's sister as a messenger. Michelle sent locks of hair to John and silver wedding bands. I think it's obvious she wanted to make sure he didn't talk. She needed him to believe that they would be together. And of course, married couples cannot testify against each other. Again, this was convenient. On March 14th, John was officially charged with adultery, wrongfully transporting and storing a privately owned weapon in a privately owned car on post, impeding an investigation by wrongfully disposing of evidence, conspiracy to murder, and murder. Michelle was beside herself. She went to Colorado to be with her family. In the meantime, the police ransacked her North Carolina house, confiscating her computer. The key to all of Michelle's secrets. Also, the Fayetteville police had their forensic analysis back. The bullets from Marty's body and the shell casings found at the scene would match the type of gun Peyton Donald said he loaned John Diamond. And Michelle's gunshot residue test had come back positive. But when police got to the scene, she was cradling John's head and had to be removed from his body so paramedics could work. That made the gunshot residue test irrelevant. It could be explained in court that it was contact transfer from John's head. On April 22nd, John's now ex-wife, Lourdes, went back to the police and told the truth. She would be testifying under oath and knew she could be deported. John had left around 9 p.m. that night before the movie was even over, after he had gotten a call on his cell phone. Remember, at dinner that night, Michelle got up and made a phone call around 9 p.m. Lourdes said he had dressed in cold weather clothing before he left. She also said that while she never heard him come back in, her mother had. And she heard him start the washing machine. Her mother had said it was really late, but she couldn't be sure of the time. On April 24th, John had an Article 32 hearing, which is similar to a preliminary hearing in civilian court. It lasted for 3 days. For 2 weeks after, officials went over the record. Meanwhile, Michelle was traveling. She spent time in Florida, Los Angeles, and Colorado. She was also spending money she didn't have, racking up more than $82,000 in credit card debt. She had not received Marty's life insurance and had quit her job with Dr. Harbin after he had cooperated with police. And she changed her name back to her maiden name, Forcier, though her medical license still said Michelle Thier. On August 20th, 2001, John's court-martial began. He had opted for a military jury trial, which consisted of 4 officers and 2 enlisted members. For the conspiracy and murder charges, he pled not guilty. But he pled guilty to the transporting gun charge and adultery. For that, he received a dishonorable discharge and would serve 3 years in jail. But his attorneys felt that pleading guilty to those lesser charges would make John appear more truthful to the jury. They were mistaken. The prosecution laid out a timeline of Marty's murder, proving that John could have been there to commit the crime. They now had Lourdes testifying to the truth. He had no real alibi. And Michelle didn't help matters either. She testified at John's court-martial, but pled the fifth to every question. The prosecution contended that John and Michelle conspired to kill Marty. They said that John waited for Michelle to call from the restaurant, and then he laid in wait, watching for her and Marty to get to her office. When Marty got impatient waiting for Michelle and went up the stairs, John, a trained sniper, ambushed him. And as he landed at the bottom of the stairs, John shot him in the head, point blank, to make sure he was dead. And then he ran back to his car as Michelle came down to sound the alarm. John's defense rightly brought up that the prosecution only had circumstantial evidence. There were no eyewitnesses or forensic evidence to place John at the scene. They also contended that Michelle had set John up. She had lied to him about the rape so that John would borrow a gun and give it to her for protection. And then she killed Marty and planned to blame John. On August 24th, the jury deliberated for just over 3 hours and found John guilty on both counts. He was sentenced on August 28th to life without parole and then transferred to Leavenworth. On January 11th, 2002, John's attorney submitted a proffer in exchange for a reduction in John's sentence. He was now willing to testify against Michelle. He claimed she did say Marty had raped her and abused her and asked him to get her a gun. She said she would shoot Marty and blame it on an intruder. John said he did provide her with a gun and then met her at the office that night, but didn't witness the shooting. He heard the shots and then saw her standing over Marty, holding the gun with latex gloves on. He said he took the gun and told her to call for help. Then he took the gun to the firing range the next day and fired it so that if his hands were tested, he would have a reason for gunshot residue. After that, he said he and Michelle filed off the serial numbers and dismantled the gun, throwing pieces in different dumpsters when they were on a road trip to Florida. He said initially, Michelle hired him lawyers and said she would stand behind him. She promised him that when it was over, they would get married. But after he was found guilty and sent to Leavenworth, she cut off all contact with him. But this proffer was never signed. By the fall of 2001, Michelle was living in her grandmother's home in New Orleans. She still wasn't working because she wasn't licensed in Louisiana. Her sister later said she was depressed and anxious. But she still dated several men while in New Orleans, which does seem to be part of Michelle's psychological pattern. Sex was an outlet for her depression, stress, and anxiety. One suitor even gave her an expensive diamond engagement ring, and when Michelle called off the engagement, he told her she could keep the ring. On May 21st, 2002, Michelle was indicted on first-degree murder charges. Police went to Louisiana with an extradition order, but Michelle had vanished. She was now on the lam. She had emptied her bank accounts, sold the ring, and everything else she could, and packed up the rest and headed to Florida. She would stop in various towns on the way to rest. On May 28th, she stopped at a motel and stayed for 2 nights. There, she cut off her dark hair, very short, and dyed it blonde. Michelle made it to Fort Lauderdale, where she signed a 6-month lease on an apartment on June 1st, under the name Liza Pendragon. She told her new landlord that she was fleeing from an abusive husband in California, and that's why she didn't have identification. Her first week there, Michelle, ever the meticulous list maker, made an official plan of action on her laptop. She needed fake documents for the name she was using and planned to use 2 other names as well. As soon as she got to Florida, Michelle got plastic surgery. She told the surgeon she wanted to address her saggy eyelids and remove acne scars and skin blotches. She also wanted a nose job and a better jawline. She underwent 6 hours of surgery, paying up front with money orders from the cash she had been hoarding. Another tenant saw her walking gingerly back to her apartment, bandaged up, and when he asked her what happened, she said she had been in a car accident. She even had her arm in a sling, really trying to sell this fake car accident. This man spent the next few days caring for his poor neighbor. He finally got wise to her when he saw a white van parked outside of her apartment and another man going in. Dana Horton was 25 years old and had been seeing Michelle even before her surgery. She had also told him she was in a car accident. And she told him the same story about being on the run from an abusive ex-husband. She spent her convalescence writing letters to her family, including instructions on how to tie up her loose ends financially. She told them to put her vehicles in their names and wanted to be sure that some cash that was hidden in the Corvette went to her sister Angela, who needed it for school. On July 28th, Dana was visiting his family in Nebraska. While there, he was supposed to make a phone call to a man named Tom for Michelle on a public phone using a calling card Michelle had given him. It was Tom Forcier, Michelle's father. Before Dana could relay his secret message, Tom told him he wanted nothing to do with it and hung up on him. This was a huge mistake. Federal marshals were looking for Michelle and had interviewed all of her family members. There were wanted posters everywhere. By now, they knew she had rented a storage unit in Louisiana, and there had been three calls from Fort Lauderdale to the unit made from a paid calling card that couldn't be traced to a person. But Dana had used that same card to try and call Tom. They now had the connection they needed. They figured he was Michelle's new boyfriend and found his license plate and where he worked and surveilled him. 6 days later, Dana went to a Wendy's, bought himself a burger and fries and a Frosty for his still-healing girlfriend. As he drove back to the apartment, he felt like someone was following him. But like the men before him, he had believed Michelle's lies and was paranoid that it was her ex-husband coming to look for her. He never dreamed it was the police until they pulled him over. It was actually federal agents, and they demanded to know where his girlfriend was. They told him his girlfriend wasn't who she said she was. Dana finally relented and told them where she lived. When federal marshals knocked on her door and said, "Michelle Thier, you're under arrest," she told them, "You have the wrong woman. My name is Liza." But she still had the hospital bracelet on from her plastic surgery, and that tag said Alex Solomon, yet another alias. She was arrested for conspiracy to commit murder and first-degree murder. Inside her apartment, police found books on how to make fake IDs and live under the radar. They also found fake birth certificates and driver's licenses. Instead of jail, she was taken to a hospital because she was still healing from the plastic surgery. And at this point, she was out of money. She had to get a court-appointed attorney. By the summer of 2004, plea deals on both sides were offered. Michelle's defense attorney said she would agree to plead guilty to accessory after the fact and spend 93 months in prison. Prosecutors wanted her to plead guilty to conspiracy to commit first-degree or second-degree murder and serve 94 to 120 months in prison. But Michelle rejected the deal. She wanted to take her chances with a jury. As usual, she followed her narcissistic ego. Her trial began on September 27, 2004. The prosecution basically put on the same case theory that had been used at John Diamond's court-martial. That John was the shooter, but that Michelle was the puppet master, holding all the strings. John did not testify against Michelle. He never did sign the proffer, and his sentence was never reduced. Michelle's defense was basically that it had been a sloppy police investigation. They cited the fact that her office had never been fingerprinted, and the crime scene was washed away too quickly. They also said that the police had never looked at any other suspects, that the police had, quote, treated Michelle as a suspect immediately, and that colored everything they did from there on out. Rather than argue their own theory of the murder, they fought against every prosecution motion and witness, filing motion after motion of their own and asking for a mistrial no less than four times. It didn't work. There was much devastating testimony from people like Charles McClendon, who testified to Michelle's double life. His finest moment was revealing that he had guessed that her password was cheater. And her friends, neighbors, and former employer didn't help either. Even family members who meant well often gave testimony that didn't paint Michelle in the best light. The trial was salacious. The lies, the sex, the betrayals. Michelle was definitely painted as a promiscuous black widow. The defense had a psychologist testify who had spent hours interviewing Michelle. She said she believed that Michelle had structure while in school, but when they moved to North Carolina, she was left to her own devices. Her husband was gone, she had no friends, and she was starting a new job. She became emotionally fragile and started to fall apart. This is why she reached out for male attention. The psychologist was trying to mitigate Michelle's image to the jury. Sex addiction was not implicitly offered as a defense, but more like it was hinted at for Michelle's character. And her promiscuity did not make her a murderer. The psychologist also said that Michelle suffered from PTSD after Marty's murder, and that is why she ran. She was scared. She also claimed that Michelle had not been in love with John Diamond, but that he had been infatuated with her. The defense's questioning about John Diamond seemed to be hinting that he had taken it upon himself to murder Marty because he was obsessed with Michelle. The psychologist ended her testimony insisting that Michelle lacked the wherewithal or emotional stability to plan such a meticulous crime. Closing arguments were deliciously dramatic. The Cumberland County prosecutor thundered on about a tale of two hearts. That of a loving, caring, and forgiving young man, an energetic and good man full of life, Marty Thier. He described the other heart as, quote, the heart of the defendant, a dark, deceitful, manipulative, sinful, cold, and evil heart. Michelle's attorneys tried to remind the jury that the trial was not about Michelle's character. It was about murder, not adultery. Quote, Michelle Thier is not on trial for having sex with many men. She is not on trial for having a sexual addiction, if that is what she had. Her lead attorney even had to address rumors that their relationship was more than just attorney and client, saying, quote, I am happily married. She is not manipulating me. She does not have me under her spell. The jury spent close to 5 hours deliberating. On December 3, 2004, Michelle was found guilty on both counts of conspiracy and first-degree murder. Michelle was sentenced to life in prison without parole for murder by aiding and abetting and a minimum of 13 years for conspiracy. To this day, Michelle maintains her innocence. She said she was, quote, a woman wronged by police, prosecutors, press, and most of all, by John. She continues to insist John Diamond murdered her husband and she was only guilty of cheating and bringing the murderer into their lives. She also claims that she ran and had to disappear because she had gotten threatening letters from John. Both John and Michelle continue through the appeals process today. Prison guards have hilariously complained about how high maintenance Michelle is, and before she was transferred to the North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women, Cumberland County's chief jailer said Michelle Thier was definitely manipulative. He said she persuaded other inmates to flood the jail with complaints and that the number of grievances tripled while she was there. These days, Dr. Michelle Thier works in the prison laundry room. As author Michael Freeman points out, working in pain on arthritic hips. I doubt seriously anyone has much sympathy for her. John Diamond's attorneys contend that military prosecutors used his proffer to try and help the state of North Carolina build a case against Michelle Thier without any intention of negotiating a lower sentence for him. And for what it's worth, after giving his deposition for the proffer, John's story has never changed. I believe it's possible John Diamond is innocent of the actual murder. He was convicted completely on circumstantial evidence. And I also believe Michelle is cold enough to have actually pulled the trigger herself. She was seen covered in blood and did have gunshot residue on her hands. But by draping herself on her dead or dying husband before police arrived, she was able to dodge these damning points of evidence. However, I know for a fact that Michelle Thier is manipulative enough to have pressured John Diamond into doing her dirty work. She has a gift for attracting men and getting them to do her bidding. She is also a trained clinical psychologist. She knows the depths of darkness in the human psyche and exactly how to exploit that darkness. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic artist by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Many of the sources for this episode were court transcripts and newspapers, but for a real look into Michelle Thier, I definitely recommend Michael Freeman's book, The Officer's Wife. What I told you about her double life in this episode was really only the tip of the iceberg, and Mr. Freeman also has excellent coverage of both John and Michelle's trials. I'll be in Cincinnati this weekend for DweebCon, so if you're a fan of the History Dweebs podcast, I'll see you there. I will be in Charleston, South Carolina on October 26th, the second annual Southern Podcast Meetup. It will be held at Tommy Condon's restaurant from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Come out, have a drink, and hang out with me and some of your favorite Southern podcasters, like Stephen from Trace Evidence, Mike Brown from Pleasing Terrors, Olivia Lind from Flat Rock, Javier from Pretend Radio, Michael from Unresolved, and Melissa from Moms and Murder. As a special treat, we again have Nina from the podcast of Northern Aggression, already gone. Though now that she has moved down south, I guess she's technically a carpetbagger. Either way, she's a lot of fun to drink with. I hope some of you can join us. This is my last travel engagement of 2019. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best, and please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.